My name's Patrick Regan, and I'm from Chelmsford. Little groupie on the front. And I run a project called XLP, which we work across London. We were telling you a little bit about in the inner city areas, working with some of the most broken and some of the most amazing young people. And this seminar is called Dying to Belong. We're going to be exploring themes of how we engage with people, how we work with some of the most broken situations in our society. If you're interested in any of the books I've written, today's seminar, I guess, is really based on this book called No Ceiling to Hope. I wrote this before the presidential election, before a lot of the refugee crisis, and it feels like it should be really relevant today, because there's one thing in our society that we need with all the craziness going on, it's hope. And also did a DVD to go alongside it for small groups. You can study it in your youth group. Half of it's filmed in the UK, in Peckham, and half of it's filmed in Ghana, in West Africa, was really helpful. The other two, Conspiracy of the Insignificant, is how I started XLP. My books are so easy to read, because I am not that bright, and so you can read them really, really quickly. And then the other one I talked about yesterday, called When Faith Gets Shaken, which is all about, well, obviously, when life gets really, really tough, how do you hang on to God? Is God any good when life gets tough, when life starts to go wrong? And the other thing is, you may see the XLP people around. We have these T-shirts on, which says, I refuse to believe this is a lost generation. So if you agree with that, you might want to grab one of those from the XLP stand. This is Naomi's, so it smells a little bit. And you might want to check that out. But I thought I'd introduce you to a friend of mine just at the beginning of our time. This is Naomi Allen. Give Naomi a little bit of a round of applause. Yes, Naomi. Now, Naomi, tell us, where was you brought up?
I was raised in Tunbridge Wells, in Kent. Royal Tunbridge Wells. Anyone here? Got a couple of cheers. But anyone else from the southeast? We'll go with that. There we go.
And that's because I got really distracted there. So you were in Tunbridge Wells, very, very different to Lewisham, where you've been working for XLP. And so what was the journey from Tunbridge Wells to Lewisham?
Well, I kind of went from Tunbridge Wells to Greenwich, and then to Wales, and then to Lewisham. So it's a bit of a convoluted journey. But when I was 16 years old, I was here at Soul Survivor. I wasn't actually here, I was at Shepton Mallet. But I heard about XLP, and I think for myself, I've always wanted my life to count for something. I've wanted to be someone who leaves my mark on this world. And I don't know about you, as you grow up, you can kind of think, God, I don't know what I'm called to. I don't know like how I can make a difference. And I really felt like actually this is one way in which I can make a bit of an impact, is by going to London and really just giving my time to serve people in the inner city. Now, I'm from Tunbridge Wells, if you've been there, and when I was growing up, it was really, really white middle class. Like, I was in a school of 1,200 people. In my year group, there was, like, one person of colour. I very much was not at all ready or used to working with people of different cultures. And I moved to Greenwich for a gap year with XLP, and to be honest, it was the biggest learning curve I've ever had in my life, because it was one of these things where thinking, I'm coming to London to, you know, be used by God to teach all these people. But what really happened is that God completely, really broke my heart and humbled me in a way where I was able to learn a lot more from the kids that I was serving than probably what I was able to impart to them. From there, I went off to uni, studied politics, and God, I guess, was really working in me about this idea of justice and having a voice for people that don't have a voice. And so 6 years ago, I came back to London and started running all of the work that XLP do in Lewisham, and that is now where I live and where I work, and it's been a blessing. Woo!
Fantastic. And just tell us about one young person that you, obviously we're looking at the whole theme of dying to belong. So tell us about one young person briefly that you can relate this story to.
Yeah, well, I, over the course of working in Lewisham, we work with loads of young people every week. And there's one young person, we will call her Amelia. I don't know why, that's the first name that popped in my head. But she is a young person who really, really struggled to fit into any kind of social group. She's the type of person who's a bit of a loner, and within her school, we ran a lunch club, and it was just about half an hour's worth on a Friday lunchtime where we'd run a load of games, and every week we'd have a talk, and then we'd always try and finish with a bit of a team game. And this girl, Amelia, she was there every week, and mainly because the rest of the time she would be by herself at lunchtime or like pestering the teachers because she just didn't know where she fit in. And on Fridays, it was great because she'd come every week and she'd always be really good at cheering the other kids on. Like, when she was up playing a game, no one would really cheer her apart from the XLP staff. But it was getting to a point where we were, like, really trying to work out how do we help her to integrate into her friendship group, or how do we even help her to integrate into her peers? And we started just by, like, giving her a little bit of responsibility. So for a while, she was in charge of, like, doing the register on the door. For a while, she was in charge of giving out all the prizes, which is a great job because everyone wants to be your friend. And then we started realising that because she was being really kind to people when they were up and when they were up playing games, and she was cheering for them, there was a couple of people who were like, yeah, all right, then I'll cheer for her too. And we got to this situation where we were playing these team games, and whereas before, generally, it would be like we would all split teams, and we got to a point where we were like, right, we'll have like a couple people who will be in charge of the teams, and she was one, and everyone wanted to be on her team because they knew that she was an encourager. And I was really encouraged because by the time that she actually finished her GCSEs and went off to college, she was going to college with four really, really good friends who I was feeling like, oh my days, you're actually going to support each other and you're not going to be alone. I think in this world, a lot of the time, you don't know which of your friends you can really trust sometimes, and like people let you down. But I was really convinced that actually, yeah, you've got people who you know are going to have your back going forward. And that was just a real blessing for me to see.
Thank you so much, Naomi. Give her a massive round of applause. She's not been feeling well either, so we're really pleased. And do chat to Naomi afterwards. And this is Mike, who's doing all technology. He runs the gap year, so if you've got any questions, they're the guys to talk to. The other thing is, if you want to set up a mentoring program where you live in your community, we can train you to do that. It's called XLM National. And again, if you want to learn how to set up a mentoring program for young people who feel very broken on the margins of society, then come and chat to us and we'll tell you how to do it. We in XLP, we have lots of visits from very famous people every now and again. And often politicians who come a week before the election for some reason, they want to come and hang out. And there's one guy who I don't really want to mention his name, but he has blonde hair and he doesn't comb it very often. And he comes. But my favourite ever visit was from a guy called Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Now, you may have recognised Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He's here and this is Nelson Mandela. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was a very, very close friend of Nelson Mandela. He fought for civil rights in South Africa. He was part of this thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I've read all his books. He's like my hero. And so I was really, really excited. And he was going to come with this lady called Mary Robinson, who used to be the president of Ireland and worked in... Ireland. And the one person here. And bless you. Someone has to. And... Actually, I love Ireland. It's one of my favourite places to preach, I'm not going to lie. And going there next summer. And so basically, he came. But the problem was, is he was coming at 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, the problem with him coming at 10 o'clock in the morning, in fact, he was going to go and sit on that XLP bus that you've seen over there. The problem with him coming at 10 o'clock in the morning, at 10 o'clock in the morning, most of my young people are either in bed or at school. So I was pretty stressed at this point. So I sent all my youth workers around the estate saying, you've got to get up, Nelson Mandela's coming. And all my young people were like, sorry, not Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu's coming. If Nelson Mandela had been there, he would have been definitely there. Desmond Tutu's coming, you've got to be there. And all my young people were like, who? Desmond Tutu, he's brilliant. And they're like, never heard of him. And then they go, how old's he? He's 81. Where's he from? Well, he's from South Africa. He goes, so hang on a minute, you want me to get up at like really early to see some bloke from South Africa I've never heard of? So I was getting really desperate at this point. I was saying to them, ask them if they've heard of Nelson Mandela. And they go, have you heard of Nelson Mandela? Yeah, of course I've heard of Nelson Mandela. He's the next best thing! He's the next best thing! He's got bling and everything, you're going to love him, you know, it's big, big bling. And in the end, they all got up, more out of respect for XLP than knowing who Archbishop Desmond Tutu is. And so we're all there, there on the bus, they're looking out the windows, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu arrives in his taxi, he opens the door, and you know, I don't know if you've got elderly people at your church, and lovely old people sometimes, they grab hold of your hand, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, and what happens is, they don't let go for ages. Has that ever happened to you? And you don't quite know what to do at that point, because it's a little bit like, get off! It's a little bit like, you know, if they're 90, it's not too nice, is it? So Desmond Tutu gets out of the taxi. He grabs hold of my hand, and he doesn't let go. So we walk hand in hand all the way onto the bus. All the young people are like, Patrick, man, seriously, what's going on? And so we get there, and we sit down. And I'm thinking, you know, Desmond, you know, tell them the stories about Nelson Mandela. Tell them about fighting poverty. Tell them about all the amazing people that you met. Desmond Tutu says nothing. He just listens. He listens and he listens and he listens. He listens as our young people talk about if you live in a particular postcode, you're worried that you're going to get a job. He listens as some of them talk about what's it like to see your dad beat your mum up and you feel absolutely powerless to do anything about it. They listened as they talked about seeing their friends stabbed and killed. He listened as they realized that a lot of these young people don't have hope for the future. They listened as they talked about their parents working two jobs and they still can't make ends meet. Having responsibility to look after your younger brothers and sisters. And then me and him, which was a little bit intimidating, I have to say, had to go and speak at an event together. And I spoke first and then he got up and he said these words. There were moments visiting XLP, you felt you're being tugged on your heartstrings. You were very close to tears. Looking at these young people who could have been going down a cul-de-sac, but then they realized the incredible potential they have when they were given the chance to blossom. Each one of these kids is a masterpiece. God doesn't create rubbish. Love that line. Each one of us is special to God. Your name is engraved on his hands. Some of us look like accidents. The most important thing you can do is to remind people they're special to God. Desmond Tutu, just before he left the van, he basically grabbed one of our young guy's hands. And it was a young guy, he had smoking a serious amount of weed, and he was fidgety the whole time. And his mate had been killed a year before. He'd never had counselling, he'd never had therapy, he'd never had been looked after. He was just basically unresolved pain, which is what we do, isn't it? We carry around pain with us because we don't resolve it. And then our anger gets suppressed because we've got no channel for it. That he was hurting, he's angry. And he turned to this kid and he basically grabbed his arm. And I remember all of the youth workers went, oh no, not that one. Anyone but that one. And he went, I'll tell you what you are. You are a VSP. Very special person. You're made in the image of God. You have the potential to change this world. And this kid just sat there and took it. And he just kept going, he kept going, and he kept going. And to be honest, that kid still got issues. But he went and he got his haircut after that. He sorted his CV out after that. He went around the estate going, Desmond Tutu spoke to me after that. And you know, the thing is this, is that has got to be the message that we say. As Desmond Tutu was leaving the bus, he turned to me and went, Patrick, you know something? You make God smile. And in that little, three little words, it was like, that's why I do what we do. We're here to make God smile. And that is what it's all about, communicating and demonstrating the love of God. You know what? Most of our young people, after Desmond Tutu left the bus, they still didn't know who he was. In fact, most of them thought he was Trevor MacDonald of the 10 o'clock news. Oh, great, so Trev came down to see us. Yeah, really good. Good old Trev. And the thing is this, is that people sometimes come to XLP. I get all these academics ring me up all the time. Oh, we need to come and study XLP. We need to work out the innovation and all the creativity you do. And ultimately, you know what? I don't really know what to say to them because all the buses we have in the mobile studio, it's great. But actually, it's all about relationship. It's all about building long-term relationships with people. It's all about loving people. And to be honest, I can't talk for a day's conference on that. No matter how much you pay me, that is the bottom line of what we do. We recognize that every single person in this room, every single person on the planet has one thing in common. And the thing is this, is you need to belong, and I need to belong, and other people need to belong. Catherine Hall, who's got a PhD, said this: a sense of belonging is a human need. Just like food and shelter, feeling that you belong is the most important in seeing value in life and coping with intensely painful emotions. We are built with this desire to connect. We're built with this desire to be accepted. We're built with this desire to feel that we matter. But yet we live in an incredibly fragmented world, don't we? Where there's exclusion due to colour and to your religion and to your background. And I was saying in my seminar yesterday on anxiety that there's more proof now that loneliness can kill more people than cigarettes, because so many people are lonely. We live in a world where we're connected the whole time because we've got our phones with us the whole time. We're meant to be connecting. Well, why are we so lonely then? The society is so lonely. And when you look at it across the world, dying to belong, people are literally dying to belong. Look at the refugee crisis. This little image breaks my heart. I saw this. It's a little kid out of Syria. He's 5 years old. He's sitting inside an ambulance on an airstrike in the hometown of Aleppo. The whereabouts of his parents is unknown. He is covered in dust and rubble, and he's looking at once was his home. His face is drenched with blood, and his expression, if you look at it, it's completely dazed. He's 5 years old. And you know, sometimes we go hard to the issues that don't make the news every night. But you know, having researched this, read a lot about this, and hoping to do some work with refugees next year myself, is, you know, these guys, they arrive on the boats. They don't know what's going to happen to them. A lot of them can't swim. Some of them go on these huge journeys across the desert. The fear, the anxiety, the pain, the long journeys across the desert. Often people get fall off of jeeps and they just get there and they're left abandoned in the desert. When they're sat on a boat, they're going to sit there for weeks, if not months. There's no toilets. They sit there. They soil themselves. They puke over each other. They're in a desperate situation. Why? Well, they want to belong. They want to belong. And you know what? Wherever there's that sense of belonging, wherever there's stigma, that's where Jesus wants us to be. Women in his culture were stigmatized. Children in his culture were stigmatized. Prostitutes, blind men, tax collectors, the Samaritan woman. Jesus loved hanging out with people who were stigmatized. So a good question for you guys is, in today's society, who's stigmatized today? Well, I tell you what, people with mental health challenges, they can be stigmatized today because they feel incredibly lonely because they think they're the only ones, where actually they're not. Refugees are pretty stigmatized today, and the list goes on. That's where we should be hanging out. Jesus, he did everything wrong. He ate meals with the wrong people. They're the wrong age, the wrong sex, the wrong ethnicity, the wrong jobs, the wrong illnesses. They've done wrong things according to the wisdom of the day. But yet Jesus learned this title. It's called Friend of Sinners. Sometimes as a church, I think we're like friend of meetings. For God so loved the world, he sent a committee. Wouldn't it be amazing that if we could offer God's truth with God's love in a way that Jesus did and work with the most stigmatized people today? That has got to be our goal, to see past what they are and see what they can become. It's easy to love people that love us back, yeah? It's easy to love that person in that youth group who is a bit like us. It's easy to reach out to them because they meet our expectations or they meet our little list of things that are important. It's harder to actually go and love the person who actually may be really difficult to get on with. Our love is conditional and it needs to be unconditional. It needs to be love without an agenda. Now, I want to show you a little clip now. This is the most famous people that have ever visited XLP and a couple of our young people who tell their stories. Check this out.
There was no shortage of selfies. Today, young people who have turned their lives around felt like royalty. The XL Project is about finding a lost generation, a chance to believe in a better life. This is the second time in 12 months Prince William and Catherine have visited the charity, which was started 20 years ago following a stabbing on a school playground in London.
So I grew up in a gang-related environment. The thing about hustling, like, it's addictive. Once you do it the first time and you see how easy it is and you see how easy it's making the life of the people around you, it's difficult to change your mindset, and that's the biggest thing. Luckily for me, that's when I met up with XLP. And for the first time in my life, I saw a group of people who was willing to show unconditional love. And also, for the first time, I had something to lose. You know what I mean? I had this group of people that I can actually call friends, and people that I look up to, and people that I don't want to let down.
I started self-harming because there was just so much pressure to achieve, and I kept failing off failures after failures. So I'd have blaze hidden all over my room, in boxes, under pillows. It went from burning to cutting, you know, punching walls and stuff when I got angry. I ended up breaking bones, and they fully changed my life back around from who I was as a young person to being broken down and being built back up. I feel like I'm back to being the person I was before all the self-harm, before all the school and the problems, and I just feel like a better person, really, because I can help other people now.
And I remember meeting a kid who wore a bulletproof vest underneath his school uniform, and he said, "I could be dead by next week." I thought he was bragging.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge listened to challenging stories. But for every one of these young people, there was a turning point, a moment that changed their lives for the better, a mentor that reached out. Elaine Dunkley, BBC News.
It's a great little clip, isn't it? And it was quite funny, actually, when the Duke and Duchess came on the bus, we had this girl there. She was 15 when she got pregnant, and the Duchess said, "Has anyone else got anything they want to say?" And she was a little bit nervous, and she wanted to say something. So then she suddenly went, "XLP, help me have a baby!" I was like, "We weren't there or anything." And then there's this other guy called Tex, who's an absolute legend. And in fact, he was on the MTV van, and he'd got stabbed the week before. So he had this like stab thing in the back, like wound in the back of his head. And so he went to Pete's Willem, yeah, I got stabbed, look, like this. And suddenly all the security guards that you hadn't seen, you know, all the sort of like really secret guys suddenly like sprung into action. And but yeah, it was incredible. But you know, Beth and Stephen, Beth's on the XLP stand. You can talk to her about some of the challenges she's faced. I'm sure she'd be happy to chat to you. But you know, the thing is this, for someone like Beth, like working in the school, you know, we love schools and, being in the school, we love schools, we love school teachers, but sometimes there's so much pressure, isn't there? There's pressure to perform instead of learn, there's the pressure for stats instead of people. The pressure that actually is put on teachers today is just unsustainable. And what we do is we focus on getting new teachers in instead of actually supporting the teachers that are already there. And actually, Beth was with XLP for years before she told us what was going on, before she felt that she could belong. But she just graduated as one of our gap year students, with yours truly giving her the certificate. Stephen's an interesting guy. Stephen came from Nigeria, and he basically got evicted out of his house. So he got booted out of his house. So he was squatting in a hotel. And in the day, he would go out and he would nick bags of pasta for the younger brothers and sisters he's had, because he thought, you know, my mum's tried to be man of the house. She can't, obviously, and I need to be in charge. I need to be the person now bringing in the stuff. So he went out and he started to get very, very angry. He used to go into school. I've known Stephen since he was 16. And when he goes into school, because he didn't have any money, so he smelt a little bit. And then if someone picked on him, he'd just get into a fight so quickly because he was embarrassed, so he never spent any time. His teacher said to him, "You're going to end up dead or in prison." And that was what was happening to a lot of his friends. If Stephen was here today and he said, "Mate, how many friends have you led us to knife crime?" He goes, "I refuse to go to funerals anymore because I don't want to imagine that guy get dead. I've just lost too many friends." And then he said, "I found unconditional love. I got something to lose now, and I don't want to lose it anymore." That's what he said on the video. "I found something to lose. I found unconditional love." This is Stephen and my son, Caleb. Stephen is my son's godfather now, so I've told him that if he mucks it up, I'm going to kick his ass. And I said that out loud. And so, you know, these situations go on, but actually the situation that we want to be, the people that we want to be, is people of relationship. It's interesting, I've had to deal with a lot of serious violence in my job in 21 years in London, both personally and with the young people. And I am friends with some very senior police officers, and they did this drawing, which I think is fascinating. Here's little Billy Smith, and Billy Smith, basically what we've done is we've tracked all the things that are present in Billy Smith's life. This is a typical person that carries a knife. What is present in his life is domestic violence, terms of abuse, broken home, atmosphere of friend, exposure to trauma, mental health, drug use, negative role models, exclusion from education, the normalisation of violence, fear. What is absent in Billy Smith's life is there's no dad. There's no secure family setting. There's no positive role models. There's no boundaries. There's no record of achievement. There's no educational qualifications. There's no employment prospects. There's no sense of hope. And there's no understanding of the consequence of carrying a knife. Now, I don't want to make excuses for people, but what I want to say is there's always a story. There's always a context. There's always a context why people do what they do. And you know, the problem is we make judgments without really understanding the story, really understanding what's going on. People need a stake in their community. They need a connection. They need to be part of something. And that is what the church has got to be all about. You know, interesting, we're really concerned about the use of girls within gangs at the moment. We've worked out that every gang leader, every gang member has at least one girl, two girls, sometimes three girls. He calls them links, a girl that's willing to have sex with you without any commitment. I'm just going to call them a link up. And actually, people think that sex is moved out of the context of love completely. Certainly moved out of the context of one loving marriage relationship. And the problem with the girls is they become victim and perpetrators. Victims, because I believe they're being abused, and perpetrators because they're hiding drugs and weapons in their bedrooms and under the buggies when they have kids. One of the girls, when I interviewed her, said this: the gangs I joined seem to be the only people in the world to offer a kind of comfort and caring. The desire to feel wanted and included in a world that seemed to regard me as scum was very powerful. Wouldn't it have been amazing if Amy, who said that to me, could have said this: the church I joined seemed to be the only people in the world to offer a kind of comfort and caring. The desire to feel wanted and included in a world that regard me as scum is very powerful. So what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about this issue, dying to belong? What are you going to do about it? What am I going to do about it? Well, number one thing I want to say is we've got to start overcoming fear. You know, sometimes when you don't understand people, you fear them. Yesterday in my anxiety seminar, I said about fear, I called it false evidence appearing real. Because sometimes it becomes this massive thing. Our media produce fear in us. You know, and sometimes our preaching is just poor. I heard someone say the other day, we've got to pray a little bit more, otherwise the Muslims are going to take over. That was the sermon. We live in the Muslim, some of our workers work in a Muslim community. After the Paris attack, some of the young girls that we work with were getting their headscarves ripped off and because people were acting out of fear. It's nuts. Parents wouldn't let their kids out to play. And you know the way we engage? Well, we read something on Facebook, don't we? And we repost it. And what do we read? Do we read the whole article? Or do we read just the headline? We read just the headline and then we share it. And that's called engagement. And actually, we don't even bother to engage with what the issues really are. What we do is we create more fear. We need to start a dialogue around the things we have in common. We both, in terms of the Muslim community, we both have a faith. We both can talk about Jesus. We can both talk about the benefits of education. We start to take a dialogue around those things and we start to build relationship and then we start to see change. You know, it's interesting. I went to the US and I went to this church, which was fascinating to me. It was 50% white middle class, 25% homeless and 25% working poor. And I wondered how they did it. And I met this lady, she was a prostitute, and for 17 years, she went around different churches, and every church gave her money. You're thinking, what's the problem with that? That's what Christians are meant to do, right? For 17 years, they supported this girl's drug habit, because she just took the money and bought drugs for 17 years. And then, what she did is they found out what she was doing, so the church has got her chucked into prison for giving false information. And in the end, she ended up at this church, and they've helped her by building relationship. This is a brilliant quote from Pete Gregg. It says this: it is one thing to oppose the prejudice of homophobia, but another thing altogether to sit and suffer with one of its victims as they show you obscene threats being explicitly posted through the door. It's one thing to sign an e-petition about the refugee crisis and quite another to listen to the stories of a Syrian man who's lost his wife and children crossing the Mediterranean. You know, we've got to be people that are looking at the reasons why these things happen and then acting upon them. Jesus' approach was to always see the power of doing things with people, with people all the time, not for people. Matthew 9, verse 36 says, the people were harassed and helpless like a sheep without a shepherd, and that Jesus had compassion on them. You know the word compassion, what it means? It's about guts. It's about organs. It's about actually seeing people for the way that they see, that Jesus sees them. Jesus' approach was, you always belong before you believe. In Luke 14, verse 12, there's this banquet, and Jesus is basically, they've invited all these rich people there, and Jesus says to them, the next time you put on a dinner, don't just invite your friends and your rich neighbors and your family, the kind of people who return the favor. Invite some of the people that never get invited out, the misfits, the wrong side of the tracks, and you will experience a blessing. They may not be able to return the favor, but the favor will be returned. Oh, how it will be turned to the resurrection of God's people. You know, there was a dad, a single dad we've been working with. I've got students, degree students, and I set them as task to try and understand what poverty was. And one of my students went to interview this dad. He's a single dad. He lives in a two-bedroom flat. After paying all the bills, he lives on £8.95 a week. And he says this, poverty isn't the fact that I live on £8.95 a week. Poverty is the fact that I feel isolated in my own community. Poverty is the fact that I have to walk my 5 and 7-year-old son only 4 miles to school because I can't afford to get the bus, and I can't. When he gets there, he gets picked on for having the wrong trainers. Poverty is the fact that my children can't go to birthday parties because we can't buy their friends birthday presents. I've come to the conclusion that this poverty is a lack of friends. I've got a few friends here. Naomi's my mate. Mike's my mate. I wouldn't let Naomi and Mike live in a cardboard box. They'd have to come and stay at my house if it got to that, because they're my friends. Poverty is a lack of friends. Because if you're friends with people, you wouldn't allow that to happen. It's interesting, working with the homeless. You know, working with the homeless is in London, you probably won't find a hungry homeless person. Not many anyway, because they go from soup run to soup run. And what happens is, my mate is head of the Salvation Army, does loads of the homeless. He says, they come in, they have their breakfast, and they hide behind a newspaper. And after a while, he was like, not sure this is what I want to do. So then, instead of just providing food, he did that. He said, well, why don't we start cookery courses? Why don't we start photography courses? Why don't we start teaching them computer skills? Why don't we take them on day trips to museums? Why don't we spend time making cards? Because everyone is a person with a family, with a history. Let's go beyond charity. Because these stories with these homeless guys are truly heartbreaking. So my challenge to you is, who can you build a relationship with in your community? What are the needs of your community? Do you know the needs of the community around your church, your school? Who's the kid in the school that everyone picks on? Who are the lonely? Who are the struggling? Can you tell them that they are worth something? VSP, very special people. Then the last thing, if we need to overcome fear, we need to do relationship instead of charity. The last thing is we've got to be messengers of hope. There was a guy, it's called Carl Medeiros, and basically he worked in Lebanon, and he was talking to a really high up guy in Lebanon, and this guy was like, I have no hope for Lebanon. He goes, well, tell me, why don't you have any hope for Lebanon? And he went on about it, and he goes, what do you do? It's always an interesting question. And he went, I'm a hope broker. It's like, what? What on earth is a hope broker? And this guy was like, I have never said that before, and I've never said it since. I'm not quite sure what a hope broker is. So he went, I deal in hope. And he was like, well, what's one of those? He goes, well, this is what I think we should do, right? We should get students, university, professionals, business people, poor Palestinians. We should get everyone together in Lebanese societies. We should get the Christians, the Muslims, and the Druze together. And we should study someone. And he turned to this high-ranking official in Lebanon and go, who do you think we should study? And this guy went, I know, Mother Teresa. She's pretty impressive, isn't she? She was the Albanian nun who gave her life for the poor in Calcutta. And he's like, yeah, Mother Teresa's a pretty amazing person. You got any other ideas? And he went, got it, Gandhi. We should study Gandhi. This is this high-ranking MP in the Lebanese government. And he's like, yeah, Gandhi was a pretty amazing guy as well. And looked very strange, but very, very amazing. And but he said, you know what? Gandhi and Mother Teresa modeled their life on someone else. And then this top guy in Lebanese society went, I know, Jesus! We should study Jesus. Now, I tell you no lie, he went, it'll be brilliant. The Muslims love Jesus. The Jews love Jesus. And he even said this, even the Christians love Jesus. And so what happened every single week in a government in Lebanon, they studied about Jesus. They studied the book of Luke. Inspiring hope in a cynical world might just be the most important thing that you ever do. Martin Luther King, everyone's heard of. When Martin Luther King stood up in Washington, he didn't stand up and go, "Hi everyone, I've got a complaint to make. I'd like you to look at my 5-year business plan, please." He said, "I've got a dream. I've got a dream of justice and equality and lack of discrimination. You've got to rally around this dream. You've got to rally around this movement." That's why he could get 250,000 people in Washington without Facebook and without Twitter. It's amazing. Because he had a dream. Vision is the art of seeing the invisible that produces passion. What is your vision? I've got a friend from the US, and he said, "You know, you lot in England, you're really, really skeptical." And to be honest, we are, aren't we? And I quite like being skeptical, to be honest. But he said, "I don't mind you being skeptical, but the problem is you're becoming cynical. You're starting to believe that change isn't possible." And I would think one of the biggest problems we have in the church is we've made the gospel of Jesus story so small. We think personal salvation is the gospel. We think putting your hand up in a meeting or going forward is that salvation. That is so beautiful and so wonderful. But the gospel is something so much bigger. The gospel of Jesus is this. It's the story of Jesus. You see, if we think the Jesus narrative is no more than answering the question, "Well, how do I get to heaven?" we have nothing to say until someone asks that question, do we? But what if the story is wider? What happens if the story of Jesus has got something to say to a friend whose mate's been killed? What has it got something to say to a girl self-harming because the school system isn't working? What happens if it's got something to say to a lad that's arrived from Nigeria and he's just been made homeless? What has it got to say to a young man who's been in and out of jail 7 times? What has the gospel got to say for parents struggling with their teenage kids? What has it got to say to a kid being bullied at school? What has it got to say about renewable energy in extreme poverty? These are the questions we should be asking. These are the questions we should be dreaming again. If we say that the gospel is simply personal salvation, we are missing out on all the things that God wants to do. We're living this very narrow view of Christianity where it's so much bigger than what we think. You know, God can use you to make an immense difference. I always thought, when I was 16, I grew up in Chelmsford, moved to London, I always thought that God could never use anyone like me. I'm not particularly academic. I'm not particularly bright in many ways. I wasn't particularly brilliant at school. You know, I've got to speak in places in the Houses of Commons now. And the thing about the House of Commons, they use words I've never heard before in my life. In fact, I've been in the House of Commons and I've Googled words while people are talking. But the problem with Google is you need to learn to really spell properly for it to work. You know, so I'm literally, I'm like writing in tongues like here, and I still don't know what you're talking about. And after they've done their big sort of discussion, I've gone, "I didn't really understand a lot of that, but I want to tell you about this young person that I know that lives on an estate, and then you can tell me how your policy is going to affect their life." And they all go very, very quiet. And the thing is, God wants to take us in our brokenness. You know, Mark 12, verse 7, he sends the disciples out and they go out preaching. And then they come back. And you know what happens after they come back preaching? They all sit down and Jesus goes, "Who does everyone think I am then?" And then they go, "Well, some say you're Elijah." And another one perks up and goes, "Yeah." And some say you're John the Baptist. And then he says, "Who do you say I am?" And then this is Peter's moment, isn't it? Peter goes, "I say you're the Messiah, the Son of God." Now think about it a little bit. If they've only just worked out at that point that Jesus is the Son of God, the preaching must have been rubbish. It must have been really, really bad. They've gone out and they've only just worked out Jesus is the Son of God. What were they saying? What were they preaching about? The fact is, God takes us on this journey and he basically goes alongside us and he loves us and he cares for us and he says, "Let's understand that actually I can use you." God believes in you more than you believe in yourself. The way to see transformation is this. This is a friend of mine who works with the homeless. Where's the love come in? I think it's this. Showing up. Showing up day after day after day. Putting one foot in front of the other and slogging it out. You know, working for XLP, this is what people ask me the most. How's XLP going? And they always want a spectacular story. To be honest with you, it's a beautiful mess. That's how it's going. It's an absolute nightmare sometimes. I'm not really meant to say that, am I, on stage about my organization? It's amazing, but it's heartbreaking. It's incredible, but it's despairing because people's lives are so complicated. The kids we work with are beautiful, But when you've worked with a kid for 4 or 5 years and then they get stabbed and killed, it's pretty hard work. Join our gap year, hooray! But you know, the thing is this, is it is the place where I believe that God wants us to be. I want to show you this video I made, and it's only a couple of minutes. It's about knife crime, and it's basically saying, you know what? If you want to make a difference, it's about relationship. You just keep going. And if you're a youth worker here, and I know some of you are, if you're an older young person here, or if you're just young and you're just passionate about seeing the world change, I want to encourage you that God can use you, but you just got to keep going. Check this out.
Please leave your message after the tone.
Jay, it's Cam. Just checking in, man. We didn't see you at football training tonight. We lost again. We needed you there, man. All right, just give me a ring later, yeah? Jay, it's me again. Been chasing you for the last couple of days. Not sure what's going on. Anyway, just give me a call when you can, yeah? Alright, talk to you later. Jay, I'm getting worried, man. No one's heard from you. Look, Neil said something happened at school on Monday. I spoke to your teacher. She hasn't seen you either. Just let me know you're alright, yeah? Mate, you've got to ring me. I spoke to your mum. She's really upset. No one knows where you are. Look, just please tell me you're okay. Call me when you get this. We'll speak later, yeah? Jay, please. I hope you can hear this. I just hope you've been getting my messages, mate. Look, you've got so much going for you. I'm here for you. We're all here for you. Look, I need to know you're all right. Just call me as soon as you can.
Yo, Cam, I'm all right.
XLP have mentored hundreds of kids like Jay. Over the last 20 years, I have sat with more mothers than I can bear who've lost their kids to knife crime. It's totally heartbreaking. It's not just the parents that suffer. It's the wider family, the wider community, their school and their friends. To be honest, there have been many times that I just feel like giving up. Their lives are so complex. But the reason I don't is I hear stories of XLP mentors and youth workers who believe in their young people, who keep making the phone calls, who want to help them create a positive future. I know times are tough, but would you consider helping us to help them? I'm going to finish by reading this. This is my favourite quote. It says this: while women weep as they do now, our fight. While little children go hungry as they do now, our fight. While men go to prison in and out as they do now, our fight. While there remains a drunkard left. While there remains a poor lost girl upon the streets. While there remains one dark soul without the light of God, our fight. Our fight to the very end. That was written by William Booth, the General Director of the Salvation Army. And, you know, I thought that was a pretty impressive. So I thought I'd give it a go for myself. I'm not quite as impressive. But this was my prayer. While young people carry knives and live in fear, our fight. While kids die of preventable diseases, as they do now, our fight. While refugees step on boats scared for their lives, our fight. While young women sell their bodies for sex to raise money for their kids, our fight. While people sit in their churches believing they're not enough and worthless because they suffer from anxiety and depression, our fight. While people try and escape their pain by their lives by taking pills, our fight. While kids feel embarrassed and lonely because they can't read and write, our fight. While young people live in war zones, are beaten, raped and left to die, our fight. Our fight. Our fight to the very end, while there remains one dark soul without the light of God. I'm going to pray, and then you're done. One thing I'd like you to think about as we leave. If you've got a mobile phone on you, you're allowed to get it out. I never hear that in a Christian talk before. I'm going to pray, and I want you to try and think, because I try and think of responses, which isn't all about us here. I want you to try and think of one person that you could text and encourage and show a bit of love to while I pray. I want to pray that God will put one name in your head, however many hundreds of people are here today, just one name, that actually maybe we could double the amount of blessing that's going on. Maybe someone who isn't a Christian, say, you know, I'm at this crazy Christian thing and this crazy guy's just been going on about this. And I just wanted to know that, I know life is tough, but I want you to know that I'm praying for you. You don't have to get all religious about it. You don't have to preach at them or quote Bible verses at them. Just be normal human friends.